who's going to reverse the disastrous decline of our medical care system into high prices, low value, loss of trust, bureaucratic obstruction, and overregulation? Entrepreneurs, that's who.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We're here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Entrepreneurship is the vital force of our lives, our society, and our civilization. Entrepreneurs are self-energized to fix problems that are raised by dissatisfied consumers. It's how the world changes and advances and gets better. One field where you'll find plenty of dissatisfaction expressed today, at least here in the U.S., but I'm also aware of it in my prior home country of the U.K., and I wouldn't be surprised if it's universally the case, is medical care. People complain about prices, access, quality, service, and relationships. If you believe that consumer satisfaction is delivered by free and unhampered markets, well, this certainly isn't one. How do we fix the problem? The bureaucratic or governmental or institutional approach is typically what they'd call systemic. Grandiose, comprehensive measures, often in the form of legislation and regulation, that are complex, obfuscating, and usually hopeless. It does more harm than good. Entrepreneurs are smarter than that. They can identify specific problems and design specific improvements. By reasoning from first principles, they can easily get to the bottom of the matter. By favoring simplicity over complexity, they can design practical, workable improvements. By relying on empathy and customer understanding, they can focus on what's important, which is the customer experience. Entrepreneurs can fix medical care just like they can fix everything else. Our guest today, Murray Sabrin, is an economist, recently retired from teaching at Ramapo College, where he was executive director of the Center for Business and Public Policy and the founder of the Sabrin Center for Free Enterprise. He's dedicated himself to researching and writing about the medical care system in the U.S., and his current book is Universal Medical Care, From Conception to the End of Life, The Case for a Single-Payer System. The proposed single-payer is the individual patient or family. I'd add that the proceeds of the book go exclusively to nonprofits and charities, so you're contributing to the solution if you buy it. Murray, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you, Hunter, after listening to so many of your podcasts and reading your writings. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you. It's mutual, and we're talking today about a very important subject in both economics and personal experience, which is healthcare. Although the title of your book is Universal Medical Care, which is an important distinction. We'll cover that. But from conception to end of life. And you're taking what I see as an entrepreneurial business approach to the consumer want of, I want to be healthy, and the entrepreneurial instinct to satisfy that want, which is why we have doctors and medical care. And you talk about one of the fundamental relationships in business, entrepreneur-customer, as we think of it as economics, and patient-doctor, as we think of it in healthcare. So I'd like to start there on the individual side and with the patient. And a first principle that you draw is that individuals are responsible for their own actions, and in this case, their own wellness. So let's start there, Murray. How do you think about that?
Well, I've always been a believer that you're responsible for your healthcare, your health. And I have a whole chapter in the book describing that, having interviewed a naturopath who had his own health problems as a youngster, and he gravitated toward the practice of naturopathy, and he's been doing it successfully for more than 20 years. So the point is, I differentiate healthcare from medical care, and I wish we wouldn't use the word healthcare when it came to what the government does or insurance companies do. We are responsible for our healthcare with what we eat, our lifestyle, our drinking habits, our smoking habits, whatever, exercise habits, whatever the case may be. And medical care is what we seek when we don't have optimal health. And I've always been a believer in that. I've tried to lead my life of trying to optimize my health care to make sure that, as I told my doctors over and over again, one of my goals in life is to be off of medication and not be in a hospital. And so they chuckled at that because they agree with that. They essentially agree with that, that if a doctor is doing a good job for their patients, the patient should have long-term optimal health care. And that means staying off of medications, which we know can be counterproductive. Every medication has adverse consequences. And the thing is, hospitals, we know that there are errors being made there. And there's a whole literature on errors being made in hospitals. And I've heard plenty of anecdotes, especially from my sister-in-law, whose husband was very ill with a form of Parkinson's. And she was a former nurse, or she is a former nurse. And she caught mistakes when he was in the hospital and in a doctor's office for treatment. So it's important to know a little bit about medicine. And in today's day and age, Hunter, we know with WebMD and other websites, you should be educated about your own body, your own physiology, your own biology, if you will, and then try to find out what are some of the possible solutions. If I go to a doctor and he tells me X and maybe Y is better for me, and start to question the doctor about protocols, about treatment. And I think that if you recall, there was a clothing store chain in New York City called Cy Sims chain. And one of his bylines, or I should say lines for advertising, is an educated consumer is our best customer. Well, I would turn that around saying an educated patient is the best patient in the medical care system, because that's when you can probe and figure out what is the best course of treatment with the doctor.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that later, because there's some challenges for the individual to get that information, and we'll talk about that. But let's go to the other side of the entrepreneur-customer relationship. And in healthcare and medical care, that's the doctor. And you start, as Austrians do, with methodological individualism. You start with the doctor as an individual practitioner. So tell us about that, and then tell us about some ways that maybe we've lost that relationship and we can get it back again.
Yeah, I think one of the best things I can describe that is to go back to the 1950s when my parents used to take me to the pediatrician and they paid $5 for the doctor's visit in the office. There was no insurance forms. There was no staff handling all the insurance claims. And so that's the vision I had for what is supposed to happen when you go see a doctor. You pay your $5. If you need a prescription, he would prescribe, write out a prescription. You'd go to the local pharmacy and you'd pay a few dollars for a prescription. No insurance forms, no bureaucratic overhang with the doctor-patient relationship. And everyone was happy. That's the way I think we're now evolving with direct primary care and organizations like Go Forward, or that has facilities in about 12 cities across the country.
Well, let me just stop there for the benefit of listeners. Maria might not fully understand that direct primary care concept yet. So explain it carefully. And I think it means going back to that first relationship, right? The doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah, the difference is instead of paying a fee for every time you go to the doctor, you pay a monthly fee for virtually unlimited visits to the doctor. You have virtually 24/7 access by text or phone or email. You also have the ability to get testing done at the doctor's office as part of your monthly fee. And to me, that sounds like the most direct, less bureaucratic, less intrusive way of a third-party individual. In other words, it's the perfect entrepreneurial doctor-patient relationship where the doctor is providing a service and the patient is paying on a monthly fee. It's basically a retainer on a monthly basis.
So just for clarity, Murray, is that the doctor then has extracted themselves, he or she has removed themselves from the bigger system and become a one-to-one relationship with the patient, is that right?
Absolutely. There's no insurance forms involved. Unfortunately, Medicare doesn't reimburse you if you use a direct primary care physician, which I think should be changed in the law where people have the ability, no matter what age they are, to contract with a doctor to get the best possible care they can for a very modest fee. I mean, the most expensive I've seen is Forward, which costs $149 a month. Dr. David Cunningham, who has Infinity Care in Massachusetts, he charges $200 for a couple. That's very reasonable in today's day and age to get full coverage for a doctor's visit. And then if you have to see a specialist, they have referrals to specialists. So it would be sort of the doctor would be the nexus of the doctor-patient relationship. And then you'd have the specialist who would then treat you for specific needs that the primary care doctor couldn't.
So these are entrepreneurial businesses. The doctors become an individual entrepreneur, and then it's scaled up a little bit to these units that you mentioned, like Forward, and there's another one in your book called Infinity Family Care. So these are slightly scaled up, but still entrepreneurial groups, correct?
And here's the other point that's really important for the patient. Doctors who have a direct primary care practice usually cap the number of patients they have at about 800. Because they figured that's the maximum that would give them and the patient, the undivided attention the patients need. In other words, instead of having a 10, 15-minute visit when you go to the doctor's office in a traditional fee-for-service or a typical third-party payer with insurance companies, they could spend a half hour, 45 minutes in a visit, which you rarely see today. And so the doctors are happy because they have less patients to handle. They don't get burnt out, which is one of the criticisms of the current system. Doctors typically have more than 2,000 patients in a traditional office setting today, which means that they're seeing a lot of patients every day, as many as 25, 30 patients a day. That leads to burnout because if you're doing that 5 days a week and doing your hospital rounds, that is a lot of hours you're spending with patients and hospital visits. So the doctors that I interviewed for my book on direct primary care love the system because it gives them the opportunity to practice medicine the way it should be practiced, the doctor-patient relationship, no third-party intervention, whether it's the government or the insurance company, and they don't have to fill out paperwork, the patients don't have to fill out paperwork, and it's affordable. That's the thing that I found really remarkable is that it's quite affordable for the average family in America today.
Yeah, and if we put our economist hat on, Murray, what the old system is focused on is efficiency. Let's run as many patients through that doctor's office as we can, the shortest period of time, and make it as profitable as we can for the big corporation, versus value generation, which is how can I give the customer or the patient the best possible experience? So that's another way in which the economic lens of value generation would result in a different system.
You're absolutely right, Hunt. This, I think, is one of the things that struck me when I was researching the book, is that how do patients get value in the medical care system? And the sad reality is today, patients have no idea what a visit costs because they never see a bill. So therefore, they can't judge whether they're getting good value for the visit to the doctor. They obviously know if the doctor is handling them well, but they don't know what the value is because they don't see the bill. So the direct primary care or concierge medicine or the go forward is a way for patients to really measure the type of value they're getting for their monthly fee. And it seems to me from the research I've done, it works extremely well because the patients have been applauding that approach with testimonials online. And they feel that they're getting the type of attention that they otherwise would not be getting in the traditional doctor's office.
Yeah, and that's another great economic point, obviously, which is that how do we measure value? Well, a lot of it is subjective, but the best signaling mechanism we have in the market is pricing. And the problem with healthcare is we don't have pricing anymore as a signal. Just talk about that a little bit.
This I find really remarkable is that in every aspect of life, we can shop around based upon price. You go to Best Buy today and they have a price match guarantee. You go there, you look at an item, you see the price and you say, well, let me go online to see what Amazon is selling it for or Target or Walmart. And they'll match that price. So you don't have to spend hours running around looking for different prices for an item that you get at Best Buy. So the point is technology has really brought down pricing for the consumer, which is great because it means that we have less time to spend on shopping comparisons. So with doctors, no one knows what a doctor's bill is because it could be posted online. And we'll get into, I guess, the entrepreneurial surgery centers that are doing that. They're posting their prices online. Mm-hmm. They also have Medibid.com also. So again, technology is one of the great liberating forces in our life, whether it was the printing press, whether it was radio, television, the telephone. And now it's the internet that is allowing us to obtain information virtually costless. All you need is access to the internet, whether you can go to the library if you don't have a computer, or you can buy a computer today, which is a fraction of the cost it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago when they first came out. So again, everything is moving toward the benefit of the consumer. Unfortunately, governments are blocking that progress with all their rules and regulations and the unfortunate situation of third-party payers where we have insurance tied to work. And as I pointed out, we don't need insurance for basic bills. I think that's another theme of my book, is that we don't need insurance to pay for these typical bills that we get for doctor's visits or medical tests, because a lot of the direct primary care doctors do testing on site, do have medication on site. So basically, a direct primary care doctor could be like the big box stores of Home Depot and Lowe's and other big box stores of one-stop shopping for your medical care needs. And I think that's very exciting for the average patient, where they don't have to go to a pharmacy to get a prescription filled or have to go to a testing center for a blood test. It's all done at the direct primary care office.
Yeah. Well, let's get there to your payment system in a second, Murray, because that's really important. You got a great solution there. But just let's stay on pricing for a second. And you hinted at this. So the internet can help us get the information if the information's there. And if we're not allowed to look at pricing right now, then the internet's not going to help us. And then we've got the breakthrough. I think it's called fee-for-service, but we all talk about Keith Smith and the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. But he's made pricing available, and he's not the only one. There are others doing it now, but that's the big breakthrough, isn't it, is publishing those prices and sticking with them.
Again, another anecdote from one of the direct primary care doctors I interviewed right here in Southwest Florida. She told me she had a patient who didn't have insurance but needed some sort of surgery. I forgot it was either hip or knee replacement or whatever the case may be. The local hospital quoted him a price of $20,000. So Dr. Bernard said, I've got to call the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. And to make a long story short, the cost for everything, the surgery, the anesthesiology, the travel, the stay was $5,000. So that's a 75% plus discount from what he was going to pay at a local hospital, or was quoted to pay at a local hospital. So again, what transparency does, Hunter, we all know, is drive down prices, because this is going to be competition. And one of the things that we learned from my research is that just because the price is high doesn't mean the quality is good, because there are doctors that charge a lot of money, or whether they're in Beverly Hills or Manhattan or San Francisco, but the quality may not be as good as some local practitioner in a smaller metropolitan area. So again, people have to realize that price doesn't necessarily mean good value for the consumer, and especially when it comes to medical care.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything in medical care, Murray. Several years ago, I had a hip transplant or a hip replacement, and I happened to see the two different bills that the hospital was going to send to A, Medicare, and B, the insurance company if I was on private insurance. And there was just a huge difference between them. So pricing is meaningless. It's a transaction device, depending on who the source of payment is.
Well, this shows you the distortions in medical care if prices are vary so widely, because we know from economics and possibly even Austrian economics is the law of one price, that a similar product or service should be priced the same in virtually the same geographic area. But you see this in prescription drug pricing and other aspects of medical care, that prices can vary widely in a geographic area because there's a lack of transparency. But if more transparency will bring the price down, 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 so the consumer will be better off, and we won't have this huge $4 trillion national medical care bill that is just eating up resources left and right in our country.
Yeah. So let's keep building our system here, Murray, from the bottom. So we've got the individual patient taking responsibility. We've got the individual doctor in direct primary care, and we've got clinics like the surgical center giving pricing. I was thinking that the next step is maybe a chain, like you get Walmart or Minute Clinics or something like that. But you've said that maybe direct primary care can scale up to one-stop shopping. And then in your book, you also talk about nonprofit local clinics that can do that kind of thing. So let's go up to that next level of the beyond the individual direct primary care doctor to a clinic and a local provider.
Well, there are two aspects to the local nonprofit clinics. One could be based on fee for service, like a direct primary care. I didn't write that in the book, but I gave more thought to it since I finished the book. But the one that I discuss in the book is the one that based upon volunteers in medicine that began in the mid-90s in Hilton Head, South Carolina, founded by Dr. Jack McConnell, who was one of the, I think, the creators of Tylenol. And I interviewed him, or at least spoke to him in the mid-90s, late 90s. And I asked him, is the government interested in this? Because this would be a way of reducing government costs for the indigent who are under Medicaid to get quality medical care at no cost to the taxpayer. And he said there was no interest whatsoever, which is shocking when you think about it, since this is a model that works all over the country. I am a founding trustee of one in Bergen County, New Jersey, where the founder called me one day when I was in my office at Ramapo College, and he said, I hear you're interested in medical care, nonprofit medical care, because I just did a conference on that, a symposium at college about medical care. And we had Dr. Gene Cheslock, the founder of another nonprofit medical center in Red Bank, New Jersey. And so Dr. Cassell, the founder of the one in Bergen County, visited the one in Red Bank and said, this is a great idea. He's a retired general practitioner. And he said he wanted to do something great for the community in Bergen County, because most people don't think of Bergen County as a low-income area, but there are about 40,000 people in the county that would qualify for free medical care in the nonprofits. So I was invited to help create one. And this is the model that works. I mean, they're providing exceptional care. The doctors are volunteers. Some of the staff is paid. In the one that I created, there's a large staff because it's open 5 days a week. So there are a lot of hours for the low-income folks to go there. The Zarephath Health Center, created by John and Alita Eck in central New Jersey, they've been around for 20 years. They have I believe everyone is a volunteer, the doctors and the staff. And they're only open, I think, between 12 and 20 hours a week. So they're not open very long. And so therefore, they can keep their costs down. And the amazing thing about the Zarephath Center is that people drive as far as 30, 40 miles to go there because the quality of care is so good and people enjoy the doctors and the staff because they get the quality care that they otherwise would not get under a Medicaid system. So this is the model that works. That could be replicated all across the country in churches, synagogues, mosques, other nonprofit facilities. And it takes leadership to do that. It takes local leaders to say, hey, we want to do something great for the people in our community who can't afford medical care through the traditional way, but let's build one. And it doesn't take a lot of resources to build one. I mean, the one that the Zarephath has, they now have a new 5,000 square foot facility. I was there, I visited it. It has pharmaceuticals that are donated by the companies. It has all sorts of other equipment there. The doctors see their patients wherever time is needed. The waiting room is filled with patients who are looking for quality health care. And it's a model that works. And so the point I keep on making, I think I made this point in the book, that if the super billionaires in our country, the Jeff Bezos, the Warren Buffetts, the Bill Gates, and the Gates Foundation has, what, $45 billion in assets. If they really want to do something great for the American people, they would build out these nonprofit health centers across the country and eliminate the $600 billion Medicaid budget once and for all and allow doctors and patients, even for the indigent, low-income folks, to get quality care at a very modest price or no cost whatsoever to them.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's MISES.org/E4BPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah, and it's a great system, and I can you draw a great story. I can picture that. I just want to think all the way to the top of the system as it exists today, the giant hospital systems, the Mayo Clinics and the Clevelands and the HCAs and so on like that. Will we still need them, or will it all be decentralized into these local units?
That's a great question, Hunter. I think what would happen is that the hospitals would maybe create these local direct primary care systems, or they would be entrepreneurial, attached to a hospital, affiliated with a hospital, where specialists would be involved. I could foresee something that we have at the big box stores, where the direct primary care doctors would get together with specialists, and they would be under one roof. So you go to a direct primary care doctor. They say, okay, you need an echocardiogram because there's something in your heart that I hear that I'm not too comfortable about. So let's go to the cardiologist down the hallway. Or if you have somebody with a neurological problem, there's a neurologist on staff, or you have a gastroenterologist on staff. So this would be, I think, an example of taking the model of the big box stores where you can get everything under one roof and applying it to medical care, but it would be a direct payment system. And we didn't talk about how you would pay for the more expensive type of treatments, which would come down in price. An example, I was at the Free Market Medical Association annual conference in August in Texas. And one corporate executive told me that they were so fed up with the price of insurance, they decided to contract directly with providers. So they had a large truck come to the parking lot of the company, a fairly large company, I think with 400 or 500 employees, to do MRIs. The cost of the MRI was $400. That same truck, MRI truck, went to the hospital, and the hospital was charging $6,000 for the same MRI. So where was the value being generated by the hospital? Zero. And they were adding $5,400 to the price of what the company contracted with an MRI company to do for their employees. When I heard that story, Hunter, I said, how would any company want to deal with insurance companies and hospitals when they can contract with a provider to get testing done for their employees at one-tenth of what it costs, what the hospital, or less than one-tenth of what a hospital would charge? It just blew my mind as a way that the medical care system is so overpriced that we could probably reduce costs by 30, 40, 80, 60%. I don't know what that number is. But the point is, if the free market works, it would generate lower prices. That's the bottom line.
So let's flip to the payment side, Murray. You set out in your book a way for individuals and families to pay for medical care on three levels. In fact, with your permission, I'll take one of those tables from your book and we'll publish it as an example. If that's
that'd be great.
But walk us through the financial planning and costs for a typical family. You say about $60,000 or $70,000 in household income. Let's cover that first, and then we'll cover the lower income people later. But talk us through that three-tier system.
Yeah, a family of four, for example, could probably get a direct primary care physician in their community if there's one available there. And you can go to dpcare.org, and I think that's the website that has a listing of all the direct primary care practices in the country. And that should be growing by leaps and bounds. At least I hope it does over the next decade. So you're talking about, if it's $300 for a family of four, thereabouts, then it's $3,600 for a family of four to get direct primary care. Then what I suggest is that we have a super health savings account. So the money you'd put in there would be tax deductible. The money would grow like an IRA or a 401k tax-free, and it would be taken out tax-free to pay for really big stuff, such as catastrophic medical insurance, whatever that number would be. That would be the actuaries to figure out with the insurance companies what a quality catastrophic policy would be. And that health savings account could also pay for more expensive treatments, whether it's cancer treatments or other types of treatments that a direct primary care physician wouldn't do. That would probably reduce the medical costs, which is typically $20,000 a year for a family of four with employer-based insurance, probably to half.
Yeah.
That's the way I think it would work out, maybe even less, because if you're generally healthy, couples in their 30s and 40s and 50s, those costs should be down based upon the actuary tables. And so that money would be in there for a lifetime. So when you retire, you wouldn't need Medicare. The money would be building up so you can get a direct primary care in retirement and pay for all the other costs in for medicine that you would need as time goes. And also that could be used to pay for prescription drugs, which would come down also with more competition. So again, the free market model not only works in every area of the economy, but particularly would work extremely well for medical care. And I think the doctors have to be educated because I think doctors are hesitant to advertise their prices because they've probably been taught that it's sort of tacky to advertise your prices on the internet. And of course, there are economists like Paul Krugman and others who say that healthcare, medical care is different than goods and services, other goods and services, because there's demand inelasticity. But I figured that out in my approach to it, that every person would be covered under the system that I advocated in the book from conception to end of life.
Cover the lower income people in this, Murray, as well. You've mentioned it, but just for completion, how do they fit into this payment side?
Well, we do have these clinics that you mentioned in CVS, Walgreens, Walmart has 4,500 stores. They could, some entrepreneurial group of doctors can create one for low-income doctors, for low-income patients in Walmarts and in Costco's and the other big box stores. So that's another thing that the big box stores can do in terms of, quote, being socially responsible, if we want to use that term in their communities, that of how to provide a service that is sort of an adjunct to the goods that they provide for their customers. So I envision just opening up the marketplace to have as many permutations and combinations that would serve customers' needs, depending no matter what their income would be. And that works for the nonprofit medical centers like Volunteers in Medicine extremely well. And I think it would work for the low-income folks who are making, let's say, the $10, $15 an hour that they probably wouldn't qualify for the nonprofits, but maybe they would. Maybe the nonprofit health centers could say, okay, we're going to provide you medical care at a fraction of what it would cost you to go to a doctor, let's say $10 a visit or $15 a visit. And most people would accept, I think, the notion that, hey, I'm getting a good service, therefore I could pay for it because I have the means to pay for it.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the term social responsibility, but you mentioned in your book very prominently that nonprofits and volunteerism is part of this expansive vision. And that's natural in people. People who have a little bit of money that they can spend on it are going to spend it on charity or volunteerism or some participation like that. So just talk about that a little bit, because it's not, you know, when we say charity, it sounds like some kind of privilege, but it's not. It's just people behave that way.
Well, volunteerism has been a long tradition in American history. Before the Great Depression, they were called mutual aid societies, and they worked extremely well, even providing unemployment benefits to their members who were tied together because of ethnicity, race, religion, work. Tradesmen would have their own mutual aid society, and they would have funeral benefits as well. And the Great Depression really changed the culture in America because people now look to Washington to solve their social problems locally. And that sort of co-opted a lot of the mutual aid societies, and many of them went under. But I think there's been a resurrection of the nonprofit sector the last several decades. I think young people are more interested in volunteerism and social activism, if you will, without the government. And I quote extensively from Peter Drucker's article of 30 years ago in the Wall Street Journal, where he talks about how the nonprofit sector should replace the welfare state. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the most free market libertarian articles I've ever read in the Wall Street Journal. And he comes at strictly from a practical managerial point of view, is that if people like what the nonprofit is doing, they will buy into it by contributing or volunteering. And it's a win-win for everybody, except, of course, as Drucker points out, the bureaucracy, which loves the status quo because of all the income and prestige they get from being a government bureaucrat. And probably the first person to go from my book would be Fauci, who's earning over $400,000 a year as a government doctor who's never seen a patient, I think, in 40 years since he's been a government doctor.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little story. My wife is on the board of a voluntary group that has discovered a way to contribute to the healthcare system is buying equipment like microscopes and powerful electronic analytical equipment for doctors who are doing research in labs. And the reason why that's important is that they can't buy them themselves from their hospital system. They get charged just egregious amounts of money, and they can't buy them direct from the healthcare or from the machine manufacturer because the machine manufacturer wants to sell to the hospital. But we can buy them direct at, you know, a tenth of the price and give them directly to the doctors. And the doctors tell us that leads to better research and new results and better healthcare for patients and so on like that. And it's a little voluntary group who discovered this way to contribute, and people like to do that.
Well, the amazing thing about the research I've done, and including for my next book on navigating the boom-bust cycle for entrepreneurs, is that people are incredibly creative and innovative. No matter what the barriers the government puts up and third parties put up, people realize there's a way of getting around the barrier, over the barrier, underneath the barrier. And I think that is what gives me optimism for the future, is because we know that statism and socialism and collectivism don't work no matter what field it's tried in. And now I think we're seeing a renaissance in the doctor-patient relationship. And the goal of this book is to really have a national discourse about where we should be going in terms of medical care. And one of the things that is explicit and implicit in the book is that people are responsible for themselves. And financial independence is what every adult should be aiming for, because when you're financially independent, no matter what level of income that is, it's liberating. It means you're not dependent upon anybody else like you were when you were a child. And so there's, I think, a social psychology here that I'd like to pursue and to point out that we are the custodians of our own lives. And if we have that ethic, I think that will serve us well going into adulthood and into our senior years.
Yeah. Well, there's a point I want to make about that, but I want to talk about another problem to overcome and help us with this, Murray. It's very Hayekian. It's about distributed knowledge. And again, I'll tell you another personal story. We had the intrusion of a health problem into our family recently, and we started looking for new knowledge and new information. It was in the area of nutrition as it relates to cancer. So we learned that, you know, cancer cells feed off the glucose and other bad things that you put into your body. So what's the right diet to have after you've had cancer and you want to stop it from coming back? And it's awfully difficult to find that out. There are so many opinions, there's so many different pieces of information. You decide this today, but then you get a new piece of information tomorrow. How is the consumer in our new free market medical system going to get the right knowledge? How can we arrive at that?
Ironically, this is the great irony of life in America today. Some of the best doctors who've been discussing this are on public broadcasting. In other words, Dr. Josh Axe, the keto diet guy, Dr. David Perlmutter, who wrote Grain Brain, naturopath I see in northern New Jersey, who I interviewed in Chapter 5 on the wellness. He points out that the treatment, put it this way, after people get chemotherapy in a doctor's office, what do the nurses usually give people? Sugary drinks and sugary food, which is the worst thing to give a cancer patient, because cancer cells thrive in a sugary environment. And when he told me this, I said, why isn't this known in oncologist's office that they shouldn't be giving people these type of substances after they have chemotherapy? And this is something that I think we need to have a national discussion about, and have doctors and naturopaths be more known to the general public as to what is the best protocol when you have a cancer treatment. In fact, one of my friends here in California, in Florida, sent me a link to an article about ivermectin and cancer. I haven't read it yet, but there is evidence that ivermectin may be very helpful in the treatment of cancer. I'm not a doctor. I can't decide that. But the point is, there are so many different treatments that are not part of the traditional protocols that they should be investigated. And that's what inquiry is all about. That's what knowledge is all about. Looking at different approaches to medicine. Last quick story. Dr. Barry Marshall, the Australian gastroenterologist, had a thesis 30 years ago that ulcers were not caused by stress, which was the traditional view of ulcers. And it was treated with an anti-anxiety pill and anti-acid. And he had a different hypothesis. He said it's H. pylori that's causing it. And he was ridiculed in the profession. He injected H. pylori into him. He developed an ulcer, treated it with antibiotics. And that became the standard treatment for looking at ulcers. So knowledge advances because people challenge the status quo. We know that in every discipline. And that's what something we should be doing during this COVID situation is looking at what people are doing in terms of treating patients successfully without having the need for a vaccine.
So it's up to us as individuals to challenge that status quo, whether we're a patient or a doctor, we've got to do that.
Well, as somebody once told me, knowledge is power. And it certainly is when it comes to every field, especially medicine, because a doctor nearly killed my father by misdiagnosing his condition 30 years ago. And that would have been a sad situation for someone who was in his, mid to late 70s, who survived World War II in his native Poland, but could have been killed by a misdiagnosis in the United States, 40 some odd years after he arrived in America.
So I don't think the system wants us dead, Murray. I think they want us sick as return customers. It seems to me that the system has evolved somehow that sick people are the source of its revenue and its profits, and they like you to be sick. They want you to come back. And so breaking out into direct primary care and individual doctors who get psychic profit out of making you well is a replacement for the system that wants you to be sick. Is that a valid point of view?
Yeah. If you look at the Go Forward website, it talks about that. The goal of Go Forward is to make sure that you have long-term health. And they do that by different testing. So make sure they can customize a protocol for you based upon your genetics, based upon your blood chemistry, based upon all the other variables that affect your well-being. And it's an incredible website. I'd urge all the listeners to go to goforward.com. I guess it's goforward.com. In fact, when I went to the website, it just had so much information about how they deal with medical issues. And their goal is to optimize their patients' customers' well-being.
Yep. Well, good. Well, we'll make all those links on our website, Murray, and we'll link to your book, obviously. Maybe I can get your help with getting all of the website addresses and so on right. So just leave us with your vision for the future, what each of us should be doing as individuals, what the system's going to be like that we interact with, and your optimistic view of entrepreneurs solving the health crisis.
Yeah, I think there'd be several things. One is we should eliminate employer-based insurance, unless it's based upon direct primary care where the company would pay for the direct primary care monthly fee. I think that's one thing. Then the employer, since they're paying so much for medical insurance, could deposit those extra funds in an employee's health savings account. And then the employee would be in charge of determining what's the best health rather than best medical protocols instead of the insurance company and Medicare and Medicaid. So if I were in charge of the medical structure of the United States, we would phase out Medicare and Medicaid as quickly as possible, making sure that people who are under Medicare now will keep it if they want it, but allowing young people to create these super health savings accounts so they wouldn't need Medicare in the future. Hospitals would have to lower their prices based upon realistic market pricing that they don't have today. And there would be transparency in all the prices that we pay. doctors would post them on their website. And finally, getting the government out of medical care once and for all. There's no reason for government to be involved in medical care. It's certainly not in the Constitution. I became a U.S. citizen in 1959, and I read through the Constitution innumerable times since then. I can't find any authorization for the government, the federal government, to be involved in medical care. So that's another issue that we should have debate. But I envision applying free market principles to medical care, just as we do to other sectors, which have allowed the standard of living for the average American to skyrocket the last half century, if you will. And I think we can do that for medical care as well, because certainly these things can be replicated all across the country. And if it's good in one location, it should be good in all the locations. So 330 million Americans will receive the benefit of free market medical care, keep their costs down, which means, and this is a very important point from an Austrian economics point of view, it frees up resources for savings, investment, consumption, and philanthropy. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the beauty of reducing medical care costs, is that would increase the standard of living dramatically in this country.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, just to finish on that note, the idea that we need to help people with, I think, is you don't have to be governed by the system. We think that the system is kind of the great Death Star that is causing us to be in the situation we are. What you're suggesting, I think, is turning it around. And we're the components of the system. We're individuals and we're doctors. And if we act in new ways, if we act creatively, if we act responsibly, we can change the system. We can do it from the bottom up, as they say, as opposed to the top down. So you're definitely advocating that kind of individual responsibility and action.
Well, I think this is what it means to, I think, be a human being, is that you have to take responsibility for your life. No one else is going to do it. And I think that's the culture of statism and entitlement that has gripped this country now since the Great Society programs of the 1960s. So three generations of Americans have been taught that it's okay for the government to take care of you. And I find that even when I was a liberal Democrat back in the late 60s for a very short period of time, and then I realized that the Great Society program is going to lead to all sorts of problems, I figured a small government safety net is fine. But then when I started reading the Austrian literature and the libertarian literature, I said, there's a better way of handling all of this. And that is through the free market, the voluntarist system that has been part of American society for 200 years.
Yep. Well, thank you, Murray. You're gonna help us make our way out of that. And that's an optimistic future. So we'll link to your book, Universal Medical Care from Conception to End of Life. And we'll make a link to some of those organizations and websites that you've mentioned. And we'll try and help people on the journey to finding out their own knowledge that can help them take care of their own health. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.